Okay, good morning, everybody.
Thank you for coming. Everyone has to make the extra effort to get here now and show this pass and that pass and this mask and etc. Which is, you get more schar halicha. You know, Rashi says that if you come to a shir, unless you can give over the shir after to someone else, you don't get any schar limud. But you do get schar halicha, and the harder it is to get to the shir, the more schar halicha you get. So hopefully we can give it over afterwards as well, but we certainly get more schar halicha. Did they not have any?
Not yet.
Okay, they're copying some. I have been asked just to remind everybody, please, to put on their masks, which you're obviously all doing, which is great. Thank you very much. And again, kol hakavod for making the extra effort to be here. The sponsorship today is a double sponsorship. We have our regular sponsorship anonymously for the Zoom Shirim for the whole of 2021 in the merits of an aliyah for the neshamas of Masasiyahu ben Yisrael, Aaron ben Menachem Lev, and Eliana bas Yaakov. So thank you for that ongoing sponsorship. And we have a special sponsor today for the live shir, so let's make it especially live, in honor of Peretz Eisler by the Greenberg family. Now, I don't know the Greenberg family. Are they here? And I don't know Peretz Eisler either. But I assume that they're all wonderful people. And I thank them very much for the sponsorship. And it should be a schus for all of those for whom the shir is being dedicated. Okay. We are on shir number 4 of 5. So next week is the last shir. The last shir I want to dedicate to issues to do with practical shmita in the kitchen, in the house, in the garden. We'll talk about that a little bit next week. This is the first Shemitah for the Manning family that we've had a garden, a proper garden, because we moved to Gush Etzion about 5 years ago. So 6 years ago, we were Motzi Shemitah. So we're having to work everything out afresh. I think I mentioned I have a real problem with my avocado tree. I don't know what to do with it, but we'll work it out. If anyone has any good eitzes on avocados, which are in Gush Etzion, then I'm happy to hear from them. I've been trying to take some soundings. In the first shir, we looked at foundations, okay? In the second shir and the third shir, we looked more into the historical issues of the Heta Mechira and the development of Shemitah, and then last week we really focused on Heta Mechira. There was a lot of material on the last week's shir, a lot of English, so I hope you had the chance to read a little bit, and I gave you 12 different issues to do with the Heta Mechira, pro, anti, etc. This week I want to move on to other quote-unquote Shemitah solutions. Look at the Otsa Basedin, look at some of the other solutions and give you some pros and some cons. But I wanted to start with some words by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein made Aliyah in the early 1970s, and his first Shemitah was 1973, 5733. And he wrote an article there, which he called Thoughts About Shemitah, which he then updated in 1994, after a few Shemitot, and has been published in his in the Sefer Leaves of Faith, which there's 2 volumes of Leaves of Faith, very much recommended, some collected essays of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. If anybody ever wants to have the opportunity to learn Torah and also improve their English and read works of great literature at the same time, then read Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, because you can tell that whatever who is writing not only as a God will be Israel, but also as an eminent PhD from Harvard in English literature, and you can get the best of both worlds in that sense. So this is an extract from his essay. If I read the whole thing, it would take us for half an hour, but I want to read it with you because it helps express some of the frustrations that we feel sometimes during Shemitah. So let's see what he says. This will help set the tone. The simple fact, he starts, is that the Shemitah year of 5733 constitutes a halachic tragedy. It is not pleasant to hear this, and even less pleasant to say it, but it is the cold, bitter truth, and there is no escaping it except through deception. Obviously, the subject of Shemitah is first and foremost the body of halacha, covering several areas, but the halachic rules regarding Shemitah reflect a multitude of values and serve to inculcate them in the body politic of Klal Yisrael. What remains for us today of this enchanting vision? Nothing but a hollow shell. The transition from an agricultural economy to an industrial one has taken most of the prohibitions of work off the agenda for nearly everyone. What options are available to the people who are anxious to observe the Kedusha of Shemitah with careful attention to all the details? They can rely on the legal fiction that woe to the ear that hears this. The fields of Eretz Israel, from Lebanon to Egypt, from the Mediterranean to the Jordan, have been sold or leased to non-Jews. I have no intention of questioning the halachic validity of the sale or the ability of a non-Jew's purchase to release the land from its kedusha. We'll talk more about that later. Let us assume that those who permitted this were correct in doing so. It is the phenomenon itself that we should examine. Those who do not wish to rely on this heter have the option of going to the trouble of importing produce from abroad. If they are willing to rely on the ruling of the Bet Yosef that the Kedusha of Shemitah does not apply to produce grown by a non-Jew, even if the non-Jew's purchase cannot release the land from its Kedusha, they may purchase produce from fields cultivated by Arabs. But what of this running to a lone fruit and vegetable seller in order to pay exorbitant prices for produce grown by non-Jews, when the people doing so are annoyed by the bother of the trip and the expense on the one hand, and half proud of themselves for their great righteousness on the other? What has this to do with the biblical rule that quotes, "You may eat whatever the land produces during its Sabbath"? Is there any recognizable connection between this perhaps overweening pride and the feeling of man's subservience and the Creator's supremacy that lies at the heart of the Mitzvah Shemitah and is engendered by performing it? Among those who are punctilious about observing the prohibition on uncultivated produce, how many of them accept and live the Shemitah year in simple joy, as opposed to the many who are waiting with all but bated breath for it to end? I do not want to give the wrong impression. I am not criticizing those who rely on the heter of selling the land or the chief rabbinate for implementing it. If I were chief rabbi, I would most probably do the same. On the other hand, I am not suggesting, God forbid, that we should ignore our halachic obligations, however unpalatable they may seem to us. The reality is that there is no practical solution that can quiet our consciences. We take medicine, but without a brocha. We must not be seduced into believing that the bone stuck in our throats is actually candy. Perhaps there is no alternative, but that is precisely the problem. That is the root of the halachic tragedy. Quite intense. And 21 years later, read a little bit from the proscript. As I reread the preceding article, three Schmittin later, I naturally asked myself, what has changed in the interim? Very much and very little. I am not at all certain that I would instinctively write thoughts about Shemitah today. This is simply because the pain is less acute. Three Shmittin have served, if not as anesthetic, then at least as analgesic. It has all become so routine. From the abyss of our normalization, I look back with envy to the early years of the Yishuv, when the halakhic issues were thrashed out anew with every Shmittah. In 5649, and then again in 5656, when any ground was given grudgingly, I recall a time when Rav Kook's reservation in the preface to Shavat Haaretz that the Mechira could be confined to a critical Sha'at HaDchak had vital meaning. Three Shmittin later, that is perhaps the saddest change in this halakhic tragedy. The assuaged pain, the muted cry, the pallid response. Ribbono Shel Olam, let us at least realize the ability to feel the loss, to commiserate with the Torah bereft of the realization of so wondrous a mitzvah. If we are indeed destined to be spectators, nay, in part actors, in this halachic tragedy, give us at least the power to recognize our role and respond accordingly. Beautiful words by Rav Lichtenstein. Yes, if I could just remind everyone to turn their phones off, that's a good reminder to me to remind you. Beautiful words, always. And you know, that's the tragedy, he's saying, that we don't really have a solution because it doesn't really fit with the lives that we live. Maybe in another 100 years it'll fit much better. Who knows how society is going to change. But right now we're struggling with this kind of misfit between a beautiful mitzvah and the life that we have designed for ourselves. Who knows, maybe with climate change in 100 years we'll all be agricultural farmers once again. You never know, I don't know. But right now we're not. And therefore we have to deal with the solutions that we have. And last week we looked at the Heter Mechira with all of its advantages, all of its disadvantages, not all of them, but many of them. This week I want to move on to a different topic, which is the Oitzer Beis Din. So let's just remind ourselves of how the Oitzer Beis Din evolved in the modern world. Have a look, please, over to page 2. In Shemitah 5679, which was 1908-9, here's some more sheets for those who want them. Thank you very much for copying them. Rav Kook, this was his first Shemitah in Eretz Israel as the chief rabbi of Yaffa. He suggested that the Oitzer Beis Din project should be initiated in conjunction with the Heter Mechira, meaning he used it as a combination. Now, we'll see in a minute why this is important, because the Chazon Ish, who was opposed to the Heter Mechira, felt that Oitzer Beis Din can stand on its own, doesn't need a Heter Mechira as a partner. But the Rav Kook introduced this in conjunction with the Heter Mechira, and he proposed that the farmers in Israel in the 1908-9 should transfer their fields to the Beis Din. Yes? He wanted the farmers to do Oitzer Beis Din to also do the Heter Mechira. We'll see why in a minute. That's not how it's done today, but we'll see why in a minute. He wanted the farmers to transfer their fields to the Beit Din, who would then appoint agents to manage the land, bring in the produce, and distribute it to the people. Remember we said at the beginning of last week's shiur that making your trees hefker is all very well when everything's in a small village, but now if I need to drive to Haifa for my this and Elat for that and this, and it's not going to work. So Oitzer Beis Din, we'll see its sources in a minute, says no, let the Beis Din take over the management of the land. The farmers declare the land hefker. I do not have any ownership of the land, the farmers say. The Beis Din then appoint agents to manage the land, reap the produce, and then distribute it to the people. Who better to appoint as agents but the people who normally work the land, because they know the land best. So the farmers themselves are appointed by the Beis Din as agents, and everybody in the distribution chain works as an agent. The farmer, the wholesaler, the retailer, until you eventually go to an Oitzer Beis Din shop and you give money, I say give money, not buy, but you give money for the produce. We'll talk about how that works soon. Basically, the money you're giving over in the shop is not paying for these fruits or vegetables. It's just reimbursement of the costs of management, collection, storage, distribution. Okay? And Rav Kook said this would solve some of our problems. It doesn't solve the problem of planting, meaning farmers who want to actually plant the land and grow the crops and prune the crops, that they can't. This doesn't help them. They need to go with a Heter Mechira, which basically says the land is free. There's no restrictions. This will only help in terms of bringing the crops in, and we'll see why that works soon, and actually distributing them out again. One of the reasons why Rav Kook wanted to work this with the Heter Mechira is, if you remember, Rav Kook had a lot of chumras in Hilchos Shmita that the Chazon Ish didn't have. For example, Rav Kook says that the farmer is allowed to water the crops, which we're allowed to water the crops, in order to prevent the trees from dying, but not in order to prevent the crop or the fruits from dying. Which means that, you know, if the farmer sees his fruits all withering away, says Rav Kook, you still can't water them if you're just trying to save the crop, only to save the trees. And therefore, the Heter Mechira, in conjunction with the Oitzer Beis Din, will enable you to do more watering and do more for the crops. Okay? And there they're only using the Heter Mechira, not to plant, which is a Torah prohibition, but to just be more lenient with the watering. Whereas the Chazon Ish said, no, I'm more lenient with the whole watering concept. You can water your plants even to save the crops, even to save the fruit. You don't need the Heter Mechira. Forget about the Heter Mechira. You can live without it. And that's why the Chazon Ish was opposed to the Heter Mechira, because he had more leniencies within the laws of Shemitah to avoid the need for it. But Rav Kook said, no, he wanted them together. And he wrote to Rav Chaim Berlin, who was the son of the Netziv, who was very enthusiastic. He said, this is mamash a great solution. The Ritvaz, the Rav David Wilovsky, who was Rav Kook's other kind of sparring partner on these Shemitah issues, as we saw 2 weeks ago, he didn't want anything to do with it. We'll see why he wasn't happy about it. But the Oitzer Beis Din project was initiated by Rav Kook. It was not continued by Rav Kook. I'm not 100% sure of the history as to why that lapsed. But when Rav Kook was away, is the truth, for the next Shemitah. He was in England, and therefore that's possibly one of the reasons why, I don't know. But when the Chazon Ish came along in the 1940s, in 44, 45, and 51, 52, he very much reintroduced the Oitzer Beis Din project. He felt it was a great solution. It avoided the problems of the Heter Mechira, and we'll see in a minute where it gets its sources from. More recently, Oitzer Beis Din was revitalized in 2008. Rav Weitman, Rav Zev Weitman, who was then the Rav of Kfar Etzion and the Rav Machshir of Tznuva, and he's now the Rav of Alon Shvut, and still the Rav Machshir of Tznuva, was very enthusiastic about persuading farmers and winemakers, vineyards, etc., to sign up for Oitzer Beis Din as a great Shmita alternative. And in the religious Zionist community, Oitzer Beis Din has become the preferred option. We'll talk about why that is soon. And this was the case 2008, this was the case 2015. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Rav Weitman, for the first time this year in his life, has said, I'm withdrawing from Oitzer Beis Din. Why? Because Oitzer Beis Din only works for the producers if people actually buy it. They don't get any money at the beginning of the process. Think about a farmer. Normally he sells to a wholesaler or whatever. He gets his money then. Under the Oitzer Beis Din, the money is delayed until the end of the chain when you give the money in the shop. If people don't buy the wine, if people don't buy the produce, then no money comes flowing back up. And people lost a... What's that? We'll see, because this year they're asking people to invest in advance, which we'll go talk to in a little bit, to try and balance some of that loss. But a lot of people lost a lot of money in 2008 and were reluctant to go with it in 2015. And Rav Weitman has written a long essay, which is in the public domain, which says, I'm not prepared to take achrayut. I cannot be responsible for the loss of money that these people will suffer, because people don't buy the Oitzer Beis Din enough. And therefore he's going with the Heta Mechira, doing everything he can to strengthen the Heta Mechira and not with the Oitzer Beis Din project. However, I mentioned the Oitzer Haaretz is, I keep getting these adverts on my phone. I don't know about you, but someone's tracking me and telling me they can stop because I've already signed up for this, don't worry. But if they're listening anywhere, you know, I don't know who's there, you know, whoever's listening. But this Oitzer Haaretz is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, Oitzer Beis Din projects in Israel, and I listed here there are a number of, I put a little bit later on, Sini Rabbonim and Dayanim working on it. So let's see what the sources in Chazal are. I'm not recommending or endorsing any products in this shiur. My wife and I have decided, we did this last time as well, they have a lot of shops all around the country. It seems to us they seem pretty well organized, although we paid our 1,300 shekels a while ago and we haven't seen anything from it since. But I'm sure it'll come through. You know, anima amin b'emun shleima. So you can take advice from your... investments may go down as well as up kind of advice. Past performance is no guarantee of future performance. So let's see. The Heta Mechira didn't have any source in Chazal. In fact, someone came up to me at the end of the last year saying, there's no source anywhere for this. You know, it was just created in the 19th century. However, the Oitzer Beis Din does, potentially. Number two, there's a Tosefta. What is the Tosefta? The Tosefta is really the first commentary on the Mishnah. There were a lot of Mishnayot, or Tanaitic material, I should say, that was left out. The word for left out in Aramaic is baraita, just outside. Bara is outside. And therefore, this material, which was left out of the Mishnah because Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi didn't feel it made the final cut, it wasn't discarded, it was kept, and it was rejoined together in a new book called the Tosefta, Rabbi Rabbi Chia, one of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's main students, and that was published then as the Tosefta, and therefore they go alongside the Mishnayot and are, in a sense, an expansion of the Mishnayot. Look at the Tosefta number two. So the Tosefta in Shvi'it says as follows. Berishona, originally, and that's an interesting way to start this, it seems to be implying, but not anymore. There was a time when the following thing happened. The Beis Din would send people. We'll see. This is clearly talking about Shemitah to go to the gates of the city where people were coming in and out. Kol mishemevi peiros, and anyone who had some fruit that they wanted to bring, food, produce. Peiros doesn't mean fruit; it means produce. Betochiado, anyone who had some of their own produce. Noikli noisamimena, the Beis Din, these shluchim would take it from them. V'noisin lo mehem mazon shalosh sudas, and they would give back just a small amount of food, so these people had what to eat. And where would they put the rest of the food? The hashar machnisin oisa la oitzer shebeir. They would put it in an otzar, in a storage, a special based in storage in the city. So this was Shemitah produce. People had, it doesn't explain exactly how they had it, we'll get more into the harvest, but they had this Shemitah produce, quite a bit of it. They say, Beis Din would say, fine, give it to us, we'll store it, because you can't really keep it, because you're not meant to exhibit ownership over it, but we'll give you a little bit back, and the rest we'll keep and distribute.
No mention whatsoever of compensation.
Not at this point. Okay, not at this point, correct. So he goes on to say, Higiyaz man te'enim, when the time came for harvesting the figs, Shluchei Beis Din soichrim polem. The Shluchei Beis Din would then proactively hire workers. Oidrin otah, they would cut down the figs. Va'oisin otah debela, make them into fig cakes. One of the ways that Chazal used to store figs in those days is they pressed them together into sort of fig, sort of looks like Yerushalmi kugels, that kind of thing. And then they would store them in this way. They would make them into these fig cakes. The kainzim osa the chaviyad, and they would put them into barrels, umachnisin osa umasila oisa shebeir, and they put them in storage, in cold storage, in the barrels. They would keep them. Higiyaz man anovim. Time came for the grape harvest, which, by the way, in Gush Etzion is this week. There's the Chag HaBatzir on. There's a big Chagigah on Friday where you can go and harvest the grapes and take the kids and all that kind of stuff. When the grape harvest came, Shluchei Beis Din Sochrim Polim, again, the Beis Din would hire workers. And they would harvest normally. They would harvest the grapes. V'dorchin asam, and they would press the grapes. V'gad in the wine press. V'kainzim asam b'chavios, and they would put the wine into the barrels. Machnisen asal oitz shebeir. Fine storage. Higiyaz man zeitim, and later on when the olive harvest came, shluchem Beis Din soichrim polim. Again, the Beis Din would hire workers. U'moisakim the masik. In Hebrew, there is a different word for the harvest of every one of the shiva taminim. There's the katsir and the batsir and the masik, etc. The shluchei Beis Din would hire workers, moiskin atam, and they would harvest the olives. Va'oitnim, they would press them together, load them up into the press, be'beis avad in the olive press. Va'kainzim asol b'chavis, and then put the oil into barrels, machnisin osol oisel shabir, and put it into storage. What did they then do? U'mechalkim mehem arvei shemasos, and then every Friday, they would give out from this produce. Kol echad va'echad lefi beitoy, to whoever needed according to their needs for the week. He doesn't talk about whether the people paid at that point, but they would give it out. Now, it sounds like this is an oitzah Beis Din. They send out people to the fields, they harvest the produce in a way that the farmer was not allowed to, bring it in and then distribute it accordingly. The problem with this is, it seems to be in opposition to an explicit din in the Mishnah itself. The Mishnah says that during the Shemitah year, you are not allowed to harvest in the normal way. Look at number three. The Mishnah in Shemitah says as follows, in Shvi'is. Te'enim shel Shvi'is, when it comes to olives, to figs of the Shemitah year, ein kotzin asob a muksa. You may not cut them with a muksa. The different expressions, ideas of what a muksa is, some kind of normal cutting tool that you would cut down figs with. Aval kotzin asob a chariva. You use a knife. Something unusual, you can't harvest in the regular way. And ein dorchim anavim begat, you may not press wine in the wine press, press grapes in the wine press. Aval dorichu ba'areva, you have to use an unusual bowl, a bowl that you wouldn't normally use, some kind of bucket to squash the grapes. The einosin zeisim babad, you can't make olives, you can't crush olives in a regular olive press. Uba kotev, and in a smaller olive press, but a normal one. You have to put them in something unusual, a bodida, something alone, and crush them. So how does this tosefta fit? The Mishnah in Shvi'ah says explicitly, you may not harvest in the regular way. And here the Beis Din are employing shluchim and sending them out and harvesting. So there are some aporshim that say, you know something, you're right, this is a big problem. It must be that the tosefta is not talking about Shemitah at all. It's talking about produce from the sixth year. Don't forget, all the grapes, all the figs, Rosh Hashanah is 3 weeks away, right? All the grapes that are still left on the branches, all the figs still left on the trees, all the olives that will be harvested in October, November, during Shemitah year, they're all non-Shemitah produce. They're all from Shishit. There's no restriction on what the way that you can harvest those produce. So some come along and say, okay, that must be what the Tosefta was talking about. The beginning is talking about Shvi'id, people come with a little bit of food, and the rest of the Beis Din procedure is talking about Shishit. And it's got nothing to do with Oitzah Beis Din. That's one way of looking at it. However, the Ramban does not see it this way. This Ramban is very important. Number four on Chumash. If you look on the Ramban, into Vayikra, on the Ramban and Chumash, he has a very lengthy explanations, and he quotes this Tosefta, which I haven't quoted in full. Let's just look quickly at number four. B'shanu Tosefta b'rishona ha'yishluchei Beis Din machzirim al pitchei yiras, and he quotes the whole Tosefta, and then he comments as follows, after the ellipsis. V'asu lahem takanus midivrehem. They made special rabbinic decrees. Now, b'rishona, originally, how you based in Eisen, Eitzel, Kol, Irva, Irva. They would make a based in store for every city during Shemitah year. Mitzchila Yitzias HaPeres, and as soon as the fruits began to emerge, to ripen up, if there are people with them, the Beis Din would encourage them to give them as Shemitah produce to the Beis Din, umachnisa sim la'oitzah, and then they'd store them. Ukashiyavos man lekitat kol oisamen, and when the main harvest came, kagoin shibaz man shel kaitz, when the summer came and everyone's harvesting the fruit, veta batsir higia, and this week the grape harvest came. Based in Sochrim Palim, the Beis Din would hire these workers. Boitzrim, they would harvest the grapes. Moisekin, they would harvest the olives. The Loiketin Koloisa Amin, and they would pick every single vegetable, or fruit, I should say. For Dorachin Mosikin Bagad, Babayt Beit Abad, Kederech Shar Hashanim. And for some reason, we'll see in a minute, the Beis Din could do this in an absolute, the regular way. No restrictions. This question in the Mishnah in Shemitah, in Shviyas, doesn't apply. You can harvest normally, you can press normally, just like you always do. And they would store them. And these Shemitah fruits which were in the Beis Din storage, they don't even need beer. Beer we haven't talked about very much. Beer is that when the produce is no longer available in the field for the animals, when it's all gone. So if you have any Shemitah produce in your house, you have to get rid of it. Or we'll see, declare it hefker in front of other people. But if you had Shemitah produce in your house, whether it's wine, whether it's oil, whether it's fruits, and the zman beer, the time for the beer, comes and passes, and you didn't do anything, that produce is all prohibited. You may not eat it. But apparently, this doesn't apply to the Oitzer Beis Din at all. Even after the zman beer, they can keep it in the store, no problem. Ach shikvar mavorin heimin abayis. Even after other people have had to take it out of the house. And everyone can eat this at this point. This is allowed for poor people, for rich people. They distribute it to everybody. All of this applied to the Beis Din. Because they were worried. Because if they didn't take the initiative, other people would behave inappropriately with Shemitah fruit. They would sell it and do wholesale and retail and commerce with the fruit. The Ramban therefore clearly understands that there is a concept called Otzer Beis Din, which they used to do but then stopped doing. We'll see in a minute why maybe they stopped doing it. And all of those who support the Otzer Beis Din, from Rav Kook to the Chazon Ish to everybody today, basically rely on this source. How come the Beis Din are allowed to do things that the farmer is not allowed to do? So we saw. Nobody's allowed to plant during the Shemitah year, but you are allowed to eat the fruit. So you must be allowed to harvest. Otherwise, how can you eat it? You're going to nibble it on the branches. Okay? So we said, the Chazon Ish explains, no, you're not allowed to plant bichlal at all. But you are allowed to pick as a consumer, not as an owner, not as the farmer. This is my field, I'm harvesting my produce and I'll sell it when I want. No, you can't do that. You can go to your field, which is hefker, as the farmer and pick a few meals for yourself, just like anybody else can. But the Beis Din, who are not the original owners of the field, who are not private owners, they aren't restricted by any of this because they are not harvesting as an owner. They are harvesting as a representative, either a representative of the poor, so they can do it, or they're just harvesting as a communal body. So when they harvest this produce, they are not exhibiting ownership in any way. They're doing it as an exercise to benefit the public. So they can do everything regular, everything in a regular way. They can cut in a regular way, they can press in a regular way, and that's why the Otzer Beis Din is able to do things much more efficiently than an individual farmer, who would have to use a shinui, and then they'd have to do this and that, etc. So when you pay, as I said, when you pay the money in the shop, in the Otzer Beis Din shop, or you hand over the voucher, or whatever it is, that money is not for the food. That money is a reimbursement of the of all the costs involved from the inspections and the management down to the harvesting, the distribution, etc., the storage. Now, in theory, you would expect this to be lower because no one's making any money on the food. No one's making any profit here. It's a completely non-profit arrangement. In practice, it doesn't work out that way. Because the costs involved of management, etc., can often be more than the market price of the food in the shops in a regular year. And the Chazon Ish was not happy about this. He says, this only works if the cost is less, otherwise what did you gain?
Amateurs do less well.
Right. The farmers have a system. They know how to do it. There are markets. They have loss leaders. All sorts of things. So there was a problem as to whether...
How does this assist the farmers in keeping their heads above water?
No, because this assists the farmers because they're not waiting for somebody to come and, you know, pick a little bit of grape from their field and give give some money in response. They can in a large way, they can have someone come and harvest their entire field and distribute it to the public. The farmer's not going to take all of the produce down to every part of Israel. And then hopefully money comes flowing in at the end. Now, like I said at the beginning, that didn't always happen. And therefore this year, certainly Otsar Haaretz have asked people in the consumer end to invest, to say, buy these vouchers in advance. We bought for 1,300 shekels. We'll get some kind of card. I don't think it'll be physical vouchers. It'll be some kind of card that you can swipe. I don't know what it'll be. But that way, that money can go straight to the farmers as a sort of upfront, a down payment, if you like, for all of the logistics. And then hopefully they will be able to hedge their losses. But that is basically how Otsar basically works. And there are many poskim that say, you know something, the price doesn't need to be lower as long as it's clearly Otsar based. Now, what is the halacha? One of the problems with this halacha is that it is nowhere mentioned in the Rambam or the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, you've got a source in the Tosefta, that's very nice, but we don't normally look in the Tosefta as to what the halacha is. We go to the classic Rishonim, and it's not mentioned anywhere. And many of the Achrodim saw this as a proof that this is not accepted as halacha, and therefore there are many people, especially in the Sephardi world. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was not happy about Otsar Beis Din. Rav Avadi Yosef was not happy about Otsar Beis Din. He felt that Heter Mechira was actually more reliable halachically in many ways than the Otsar Beis Din. Because they said this is not halachically paskin by the Rishonim, but others, many others, like I mentioned, Rav Kook, the Chazon Ish, ruled that the Otsar Beis Din was a practical option. And as I mentioned, there are many Otsar based in this Shemitah. Otsar Haaretz, I listed the Rabbanim, the Dayanim there on the Beis Din, Rav Abotbol, Rav Amichai, Rav Ariel, Rav Eliyahu, Rav Shmuel Eliyahu. Interestingly, even though his father was not a big fan of the Otsar Beis Din, Rav Eliezer Igra, Rav Dov Lior. People that you would expect to be connected with this. By the way, Shemitah is also big politics. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you this, as well as Halacha and Hashkafa. For example, back in 2000 and whenever it was, 13, when there was a big debate as to who was going to be the new chief rabbi, was it going to be Rav Yonah Metzger or Rav Yaakov Ariel? There was a lot of pressure brought by the Haredi world to favor Rav Metzger as the candidate, because he would not support the Heter Mechira as much as Rav Ariel said he would have done. Now, you may feel in retrospect that that was a bad decision, and that really rebounded in ways that no one expected. And okay, fine, but I'm saying that Shemitah and Heter Mechira and Otsar Beis Din, there are lots of political issues that are going through these as well. Okay, let's go on a little bit faster. Pros and cons. So I brought you some pros and cons of Otsar Beis Din. Pros here, middle of page 3. It does enable large-scale harvesting distribution. It does avoid any problems of shamur and ne'evad, because the farmers are not guarding their produce. They're not working their produce. The Beis Din are guarding it, and they're not the owners. Okay. Halachically, it's less problematic than the Heter Mechira, according to many poskim. The produce does have kedusha shvias, though. Most people who even maybe support the Heter Mechira, they hold that the produce does not have Kedusha Shvias. With Otsar Beis Din, the produce definitely has Kedusha Shvias, although the money does not. That's one of the concerns I mentioned last week, of if you buy Shemitah produce, then when they give you the food and you give over the money has Kedusha Shvias. And therefore, if you do not trust that this particular seller will use that money properly, that's already a halachic problem of Lifnei Iver. You're causing somebody or assisting somebody in doing something wrong. This is not a problem for Otsar Beis Din because the money does not have Kedusha Shvias because you're not paying for the produce. You're paying a reimbursement for the distribution, etc. It supports Israeli agriculture and in theory it should be cheaper, but don't bank on it. Cons. It's not halakhically perfect. Many people do not support it. As I said, many of the classic poskim did not mention it. It's hard to supervise. It's complicated to set up. And it can't be done as a sham, it has to be done in a very halachically secure way. And as I said, it's a risk economically for the producer. Now they're trying to hedge by getting some money in, but in the past many people have lost a lot of money. And like as I mentioned before, it doesn't help you with the planting. If you want to plant and use the field in a regular way, the oats-based-in will not help you. That's why oats-based-in vegetables are only available at the beginning of the year. At this part of the year, or let's say in a month from now, where the oatsa is picking vegetables that were already growing from the sixth year, but we'll have Kedusha Shvias, because with vegetables it goes by the time that you pick them. So for a few months, there will be vegetables in the oats-based-in shops, which are through the oats-based-in system. But come November, December, that's all going to be gone, and then there'll be a kind of a downturn, and then the fruit will start to come in next year. Now, the oats-based-in shops don't only sell oats-based-in produce, and they will label very clearly what produce they sell. They won't normally sell hetzemachira, regular hetzemachira, because that kind of defeats the object. But they will sell, for example, produce from the Arava, maybe in combination with hetzemachira. We'll talk about that in a minute. Imported produce where you can't get some stuff in Israel. So you don't have to, you know, worry that your oats-based-in shop will just have the three vegetables that are available this week. They will give you a selection, but they'll give you a selection which prioritizes the oats-based-in where possible, and then only where needed goes to imports and maybe even Yivel Nochri from non-Jews where there's no other alternative. Yes, sir?
These vouchers...
Yes.
Are these shops
going to
accept those vouchers?
Right, so they...
January, February for the non-oats-based...
Oh, so good. I've no idea. I don't know how it works.
It said yes on the website.
It said yes, they'll accept the vouchers for anything in the shops?
No.
Even the produce which is not the oats?
It
makes sense that they would. Why would they not? Because the purpose of the vouchers is just to get some money in up front to help the farmers, you know, feel secure with it. You don't need to spend this money dafka on Kedusha Shvias produce. You could spend this money on anything. The point is to get the money in. So that makes sense, what you're saying. So there are pros and cons. Many of the religious Zionist Rabbonim, Rav Rimon for one, favor Oitzer Beisdin as the ideal, or as Rav Lichtenstein might say, the least unideal, okay, option that we have. As I said, Rav Weitman is concerned about the financial risk to the producers. He's the Rav of Tznuva. I imagine he's been under a lot of pressure to say, look, this is all very nice halachically, but you know, we have a bottom line here and we need to make it work. But usually the Oitzer Beisdin is promoted by most of the Dati Lumi Rabbanim. Others, by the way, not so much. Rav Aviner, for example. Rav Aviner is a Fabrenta Hetemachira person. Meaning he's not someone who is inclined towards leniencies in many issues, but he feels that Hetzmachira is an extremely important national project which he wants to support. And therefore different Rabbanim have different approaches to this. Okay, go over to page 4. Let's just summarize in a few minutes the pros and cons of the Hetzmachira. We talked about this at length, but it's always good to do a bit of chazara. Pros. What are the pros of the Hetzmachira? If it works, of course. If it doesn't work, then you can forget about the pros. No concept of svichin, concern of svichin. Remember, svichin are vegetables that could have been planted, that grew by or could have grown by themselves. We're not worried. The land is sold to a non-Jew. No problem with sham of a neva. There's no kedusha shvius if you consider that a pro. And again, that's a hashkafa point. If I say this food does not have kedusha shvius, do you say, oh, good, because I'm worried, I don't know what to do with it? Or do you say, oh, chaval, I was looking forward to eating. That depends on your ahava yira balance in life, okay? It supports the Israeli economy. Obviously, you get plentiful food because it's like a regular year, good prices. It's a very acceptable solution for the non-religious consumers and traders who anyway would break Shemitah. They don't care. So it's a great solution to avoid and to avoid ignoring Shmita entirely, and it protects contracts. We talked last week. Don't forget, if a Jewish farmer producer in Israel has to give up a contract for a year, it's not a year. He may never get the contract back. The people who are buying might not come back to him next year. They'll say, sorry, we now have a relationship with somebody else. The cons, we said, many, many disputed halakhic positions. It's not clear that Shmita today is really the Rabbanon, which the whole thing really rests on. It's not at all clear that land owned by a non-Jew is released from Shemitah. The whole Hetzemachira assumes that. If that doesn't work, nothing. You didn't do anything to help. So all of these halakhic questions are very much disputed, but there is a machlokus on them. If it doesn't work, the farmers now are doing all sorts of prohibitions during Shemitah because the fields really still belong to them. If it doesn't work, the vegetables will be prohibited as svichin. Many people who are not happy about the Hetzemachira will eat the fruit but not the vegetables. Because they'll say, b'dieved, the fruit, the only concerns is that the farmer worked it and he guarded it, but it grew by itself. Whereas the vegetables were planted by the farmer, and therefore that could be prohibited as svichin. Although I mentioned I sat next to a senior Rosh Hashiva a couple of weeks ago at a wedding and talked to him about Shemitah, and he said, no, this is not so straightforward. That just because it's planted during the Shemitah year, even if you don't hold so much by the Hetz Mechira, it may still not be a problem. And he gave me about six different reasons why, I've listed some in the footnotes, why Svichi might not even be a problem. It's meant to be a knas. It's meant to be a fine to stop people cheating. Well, does that apply to someone who doesn't care anyway? That's an interesting concept. When the rabbis instituted a knas, a fine, to prevent bad behavior, does that even apply to someone who couldn't care less? So he gave me all sorts of reasons why it might not be as much of a problem. If it doesn't work, the produce has Kedusha Shvius. And by the way, there are people who treat Hetz Mechira with Kedusha Shvius. Rav Kook recommended to treat Hetz Mechira produce with Kedusha Shvius. That's not normally the practice. Even if it does work, do the farmers follow the rules? They give them all these rules. You have to not do Torah work and use non-Jews. Do they even follow the rules? Selling land in Eretz Yisrael, we said, was a major question. Even if you use a Ukrainian Ger Toshav, whose grandparent, whatever, like we saw last week, and is the sale a real sale? So there are lots of pros and cons with Hetz Mechira. Like I mentioned last week, many of the people who don't hold by Hetz Mechira, b'dieved, they'll hold by it. Meaning, even Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was not so keen at all on Hetz Mechira, he would tell the Bochrim in Kol Torah, okay, but if you're going to relatives, you know, you don't want to cause Shalom Bayis issues, it's not treif. Those people who say, Hetz Mechira is as treif as chazer, like, you know, then, I don't know where they're coming from exactly. Well, I do know where they're coming from, and it's not so halachic. It's become a real whipping horse, if you like, of between the different hashkafas in this country. Let's talk about a couple of other options. What other options are there? Okay, so Hetz Mechira, problematic. Oitzer Beis Din, okay, limited maybe. What about using product from Shishit? Let's just use produce that grew this year. Okay, that's fine. There's nothing to talk about. There's no Kedusha Shvius. It's all regular. The problem is there's not much of it. You know, after a certain point in the year, it'll just run out. Ah, keep it in the freezer. Okay, so you know what cucumbers have been in the freezer for 6 months taste like. You know, the quality of the food goes down and down. And shishit is therefore only an option for a certain amount of time. It won't solve the problems. What about imported produce? People sometimes incorrectly call this yevul nochri. Really, yevul nochri means produce is produced in Israel by non-Jews. This is really yevul chul. Imported produce from Chutz La'aretz. Now, obviously, again, there's no problems halachically. This comes from Greece. This comes from Turkey. There's no Kedusha Shvius according to anyone. But there are cons as well. It damages the Israeli agricultural sector if you suddenly switch to imported produce, and that's billions of dollars a year. It can be expensive. You know, if you want to go and buy grapes in January from South Africa, you know how much they cost. They're not as cheap as they are today. The supply is unreliable. And also, there are political, economic considerations. Oh, I'll buy my stuff from Jordan. It's fine. What? Is that fine? I don't know. Are you happy to be supporting other countries who are not always so pro-Israel? Is that a political, irrelevant concern? So that, again, is a hashkafic question. Do you regard political realities in the modern Middle East as relevant hashkafic considerations? Well, if you're a religious Zionist, of course you do. It's all part of the Geula consideration. We talked about that at great length. If you're Haredi, you say, no, we don't mix politics with halacha. Yeah? The fact that I buy from Jordan is nothing to do with halacha, and others would disagree with that. Let's talk about yevul nochri for a second. Let's buy our produce from all the non-Jews in Israel, from Arabs in the Galil, in Yehuda v'Shomron. Quite potentially, yes. Meaning, Gaza, we'll talk about the boundaries of Eretz Israel. It's not so straightforward. When we used to get produce from Gush Katif, because there were added considerations that it was grown above the ground. We'll get to that in a minute. But Gaza, produce from Gaza, it doesn't have the same din of Shvius, because it's outside the Ole Bavel border, but it's within Ole Mitzrayim, potentially. And then you have the whole, you know, consideration of whether you want to be paying money in order that they can, you know, they're not firing cucumbers when they fire out of Gaza. They're using that money for other things. But there's a more problematic still. Is that we said there's a major, major halachic debate as to whether a non-Jewish Jew's ownership of the land of Israel does anything to withdraw Shemitah status. And this is a debate in the Gemara. We didn't have time last week to speak it all out, but this is a machlokas in the Gemara. One view says, yes, if a non-Jew owns land in Israel, that project does not have Shemitah status. Another view says it does. And this is a machlokas in the Rishonim, and it's usually expressed as a machlokas between the Bet Yosef and the Mabit. The Bet Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, says that if a non-Jew owns land, it does not have Shemitah status, which, as we said last week, was a stringency, because they said if they produce Shemitah produce, then it has to have Trumas and Maestras taken from it. Whereas Rav Moshe Detrani, the Mabit, also in Sfat, opposed this and says, no, it doesn't help. It still has Shemitah status. It doesn't do anything to the land. And then there's the whole question, did the Bet Yosef withdraw his position later on in life? Many people said that he did, in which case it doesn't work according to everybody. And therefore, eating produce which is produced by non-Jews in Israel is not it's not even a safe halakhic option. People present this as if, oh, this is the safest option. Lav dafka. And according to the Chazon Ish, it doesn't work at all. The B'nai Brakas do not follow this. The Eidah Haredis from Yerushalayim follow this. If you're looking ever for a leniency that the Eidah Haredis promote widely, so this is one to remember. Okay, that you can eat produce produced by a non-Jew in Israel, and it doesn't have any Kedusha Shvius. And as I said, some people do treat this with Kedusha Shvius. And I put here some of the pros and cons, looking on page number 5 at the top. I brought you some of the pros, in the sense that there's no Kedusha Shvius, if that is a pro, although it's not clear. Many cons. There are unscrupulous Jewish producers that just sell their products to Arabs, who then sell it on as if they'd grown it. So that happens. That not all the land which is used by Arabs is legally owned by those Arabs. And therefore, in halacha, this would have full Kedusha Shvius. Some of the producers are in areas which are very hostile, and it's dangerous for the mashgichim to go there, which is a consideration. And often they just can't go there, in which case, how do you know what's going on? You don't know anything about it. And one of the big issues, of course, is it strengthens the hold of the Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Arabs of land in Eretz Israel. And there is, the JNF worked wonderfully, buying up little pieces of land bit by bit by bit by bit in order to create a yeshuv. And the Arabs have seen this, and there are now Arab versions of the JNF, I don't know what they call it, the ANF or something like that, and they are trying to, bit by bit, piece by piece, get back land in order to create a status quo on the ground, which will be an Arab state within, etc. That's one of the, and the Galil is still a shaky situation. We went for a few days to the Galil last week, just as a break, and you know, you really don't feel it's a very Jewish place, you know, when you drive around a lot of the Galil, which is fine, you know, happy for everyone to live there. But more Jewish people need to go live in the Galil, and certainly strengthening the Arab hold on the land there is a real consideration, not to mention the damage it causes to Israeli industry, agriculture, I should say, etc. So, pros and cons. Let's talk about something else. Two more things before we finish. Let's talk about matzah menutak. Now, matzah menutak is nothing to do with what you eat on Seder night. Matzah here is with an ayin. If I pronounced Hebrew better, it would be clear. It would be matzah menutak. Okay, but I don't. How does this work? So matzah menutak means that instead of growing the produce in the ground, they grow it above the ground and inside. Let's talk about the halakhic issues here. What is the status of plants inside your house during Shemitah? So look at number 5, Talmud Yerushalmi. Rabbi Yochanan b'shem Rabbi Yonai says the following: Ilan shenat'u betoch habayit. You have a tree inside the house. Okay? Let's say you've got a piece of, not necessarily in a pot, but it's in the ground, you've got a piece of ground. There are people who have trees inside the house, like a feature, whatever, planted in the house, but it's not outside. Chayav b'orla. So first of all, he says, orla makes no difference inside or outside the house. Upatur min ha-masrot. And in terms of trumas and ma'ol, at least masa, it's not, there's no problem of masa at all. Dichsiv, why? It says, aser ta'asa et kol tvuat zarecha hayotze hasadeh. It says sadeh with maser. And this is not in a sadeh. It may be planted in the ground, but it's certainly not in a sadeh. It's in your living room. Ubeshvi'it, but when it comes to shmita, says the Rishami, tzricha. What does tzricha mean? We need. What do we need? So the Pnei Moshe, classic commentary on the Rishami, says, ule'inye shvi'is, misbekalan. We are not clear that tzricha lemiboy. We need to ask. We need a solution. Shmita is not clear. Dichsiv, why? Because with Shmita, you've got both. It says, "V'shavta aret Shabbos Lashem." The whole country has to rest. Well, my salon is included in the whole country, so maybe my tree in my salon is included. Uksiv, on the other hand, it says, "Sadcha lo tizra v'charmacha lo tizmor." It's a sadcha, and this is not a sadeh. So with shmita, it's a sofek, a tree inside the house. So the poskim go in different directions on this. Some are stringent, I brought you the sources, some are lenient. So that's one safek. Whether a tree inside a house or an enclosed structure is or isn't subject to Shemitah at all. A second question is, forget about inside. What if I grow something in a pot? Is that called the ground? So here we have an opportunity to look at three Mishnayos, including, I'm very excited to say, a Mishnah in Uksim. When is the last time? It's taken us 228 shiurim to bring a source from the Mishnayos in Uksin. So for me, this is a red letter day. Okay? Okay, number six. The Mishnah first in Demai. At Sitz, which is the modern Hebrew as well, a flower pot, plant pot. At Sitz Nakuv, if a pot has a hole in the bottom, as I'm sure anyone who has any gardening background will know, that it's very often the case that if you're going to put something in a pot, you have to drill a hole in the bottom for drainage as well, otherwise it becomes waterlogged, all sorts of things like that. So an atzitz, a pot with a hole on the ground, harizeh ka'aretz. It's just like the ground, meaning you've got an olive tree in a pot, the pot has holes in the bottom. As far as I'm concerned, says the Mishnah, that's called on the ground. Yes. We'll get to that in a minute. We're talking about on soil right now. Okay. So that's like the ground. And that's true, by the way, in Hilchos Shabbos as well. Looking at number seven, Mishnah in Shabbos. Hatoilesh me'atzitz nakuv. If I go to my back garden, I have an olive tree in my front garden, which is in a pot. It's in a pot because someone actually gave it to me as a present for my 50th birthday. I had a surprise party, actually here in the OU Israel Center. Strangely enough, but there's a whole story behind that, okay? But I walked to the OU Israel, thinking I was coming here to do something completely different. And it turned out there were a whole group of people who said, surprise, and I had a... So someone bought me an olive tree in a pot. So I took it home in the car, which was no small feat, I must tell you, a little olive tree. And it stands in a pot in my front garden, okay? So, hatolesh me'atzit nakuv, but there are holes in the pot for drainage, etc. If I go out on Shabbos and pull a twig off that olive tree, chayav. That's chayav. I broke Shabbos. It's kotzer, full daraisa. She'ein nakuv, but if I didn't have holes in it, it's just sitting in a pot, but not connected with the ground, patur. Patur means it's an issa d'rabbanan. It's prohibited, but I'm not liable to bring a korban, etc. The truth is, it's actually more complicated than that, because even if it doesn't have holes, if the branches or the leaves overhang the pot and actually are over the ground, that may be as good as being in the ground, because whatever vibes are coming up from the ground, if you like, agriculturally, that's affecting them too. Okay, good. What about, how big is a hole? This is a question for you. When is a hole a hole? I mean, what is it, a micrometer big? Is that a hole? So luckily, there's a Mishnah that asks exactly that question. Number eight. This is a Mishnah in Uksin, and it says the following. Atzitz nakuv einu machshir et azra'im. What's this talking about? Machshirin, another topic we've never mentioned in the Shir, as far as I can remember, is if you look in the Torah, you'll see that fruit that grows from the ground is only makabel tuma. If I have an apple and I pick it off the tree, it's only makabel tuma once it's been washed. If it's never come into contact with water, then even if I touch it on a dead dog or whatever it is, or a sheretz or what, or a zav, it won't pick up any tumah, only once it's been washed. There's all sorts of questions. Why is that? Rav Hirsch says, because nobody eats fruit unless it's washed. You know, and he didn't even have any pesticides in the 1800s. But therefore, fruit only has a din of fruit once it's been prepared for human use. Okay, fine. So, obviously, the stuff that's growing from the ground gets rain on it all the time. No, it only counts once you've detached it from the ground. Once you've detached it from the ground, then the water will be machshir, will prepare it to receive tumah. But whilst it's still connected to the ground, it won't do anything. So here we are. And that sits, which has a hole in it, einu machshir es hazraim. It's still in the ground. And therefore, water or liquid will not in any way prepare it for tumah. V'she'enu nakov, if it has no hole in it, machshir et hazraim, then it's called detached from the ground. And therefore, if you pour water on it, that will prepare it for tumah. Ah, kama hu shiur shel nekev. How big is a hole? K'dei sheyatzabot shoresh katan. big enough for a little root to get through. Ah, so now you know when a hole is a hole. But when is a root? That's the question. What is called a little root? So that the Mishnah doesn't define. But Rav Rimon already defines a root already as 1 millimeter. There are roots, very tiny roots, and even if it's 1 millimeter, that is a hole. And therefore, almost any hole that you're going to have in a pot is holy enough. Yes? No, they use it. No. That's much bigger. Right. That kind of hole. Here, Rav Rimon says 1 millimeter. Okay, so there's a suffix. What is the din of fruit grown in the house? Question. What is the din of a fruit grown with it, which is detached from the ground? Now, we talked about hechsher and machshirin. The halakhic position on trumas, maestris, kilayim is very clear. But the mefarshim never discuss shmita. The classic mefarshim never discuss shmita and the whole question. So you have another suffix. So what they do is as follows. Okay, Chazanish said, stuff that grows in the house is one suffix. I'm not going to be lenient. Stuff that grows outside in a pot without a hole even, I don't know, it's a suffix. With a hole, there's no suffix, it's in the ground. But if you grow it inside the house and in a pot with no hole, oh, then already you've got too many svekas, too many questions to really be stringent on this. And therefore, Matzah Menutak, go over the page to 6, please. I brought you a little picture. Is they grow the produce over the ground. It's not connected to the ground. They put plastic sheeting down underneath it, something which is completely impervious. So there's no connection with the ground at all. They raise it off the ground and they have it indoors. And by the way, indoors is another question. How indoors does indoors need to be? Okay, so a roof and walls, definitely. What about a roof and no walls? Is that called indoors? What about a roof which is made of mesh, but not solid? How much mesh is needed to call it an ohel? You see how all of these issues become so interesting, and so many factors go into this in order to get to a psak. Lemaisa, next week I'll mention what to do with pot plants in the house. But in terms of matzah menutak, most poskim are lenient with matzah menutak on condition that the pots and the plants are inside a structure, they have no holes, they are detached from the ground, and some also add that they have to be owned by non-Jews. And as a chumrah, if you like, many of the plant holders are sold to non-Jewish owners. And there is no concern of selling land in Eretz Israel, because you're selling grow bags in Eretz Israel, not land, and that's fine. And also they get any malacha on a Torah level to be done by non-Jews as well. And also don't forget, you always have the overriding question as to, is any of Shemitah today on a Torah basis or a rabbinic basis at all? So matzah menutak is a good solution. Pros and cons I've brought you there. Also, you end up with bug-free produce as well, which is another nice pro too. But it is a limited supply, it is expensive, etc. The last thing I just want to consider before we finish is produce grown outside the boundaries for Shemitah. Please look here in number 9. Shalosh Arzos L'Shvi'is. The Mishnah in Shvi'is already says there are 3 different areas in Israel and around for Hilchos Shvi'is. Kol Shehig Zika Ole Bavel, anywhere that the Ole Bavel, the people that came up with Ezra in the Second Temple period, anywhere that they settled, Me'eretz Yisrael, the Akhsiv, all of Eretz Yisrael until Ksiv. Ksiv is the northern boundary. It's now called, it's near Nachal Achziv. It's just north of Nahariya. Lo Nechal, that's absolutely Israel. You cannot eat stuff that grew there. Has Kedusha Shvi'is, you can't eat it regularly. The Lo Nevad, you can't work the land. That's full Eretz Yisrael. Okay? By the way, there's a machloikas as to, does Ole Bavel mean Ezra? Or anywhere that even the Hasmoneans, the Hashmonaim, conquered in Second Temple? There's a big difference. Then he goes on, V'kol she'il ziku Ole Mitzrayim, anywhere that the wasn't settled in the Second Temple, but only by the Ole Mitzrayim with Yoshua. And then it gives another northern boundary, Mechziv the Ad HaNahar. You know, you couldn't have pages and pages of analysis on which Nahar. Is it the Litani, like a bit further north? Is it talking about Nachal Mitzrayim? Is it talking about the Euphrates? Not for now. The Ad Amana, from there to Amana, which is somewhere near Damascus probably. Nechal, it has, you can eat it, there's no problem with Svichin, there's no problem with Kedusha Shvi'is. Avalon Nevan, you can't work the land. It has some leniences, but not full. And then finally, Min Anarav Amana Ulithnim, from there outwards over the rest of the world, Nechal v'nevad. You can do what you like with it. And therefore, one of the sources of produce in the Shemitah year is produce which lays outside the Ole Bavel areas. Ole Bavel really has full Shemitah status. But once you get to Ole Mitzrayim, then there are leniences. There's no problem with Svichin. You can combine this with the Heter Mechira. Less of a concern with the Heter Mechira, because anyway it's outside or in the question zone, in the twilight zone. And therefore you will see in the shops labels, Ole Mitzrayim, yeah, and Heter Mechira, or Ole Bavel and Heter Mechira. Ole Bavel and Heter Mechira is full-blown Heter Mechira. If you don't hold by it, you don't eat it. But Ole Baba, Ole Mitzrayim and Heter Mechira, oh, okay, you know, could be that Heter Mechira is more acceptable, and you'll see that too. By the way, there is a brighter in the Yerushalmi about the borders of Eretz Yisrael that they discovered written on the floor of a synagogue near to Bet Sha'an. Bet Sha'an's on the border, right there, right there. And on the floor of the ancient synagogue, they found this brice in the Yerushalmi. I brought you a couple of maps. If you just look now on page 6 and page 7, rough maps of Ole Bavel, Ole Mitzrayim. There's a whole conversation about the Western Negev. Where are the lines? If you're into geography, I've seen things that they're putting out the exact coordinates, north and west, and how that works, etc. But Lamaisa produce from the Arava, meaning down near Elat, is almost certainly outside all of these boundaries. By the way, it goes the other way as well. Can you send Shemitah produce down to Elat? Or is that considered exporting it from Eretz Israel? That's also a question as to how that works. Therefore, Arava produce, and sometimes from the southern Negev as well, gives a supply. Right at the very end, I've given a very rough idea of the preference order that different communities follow. The Haredi community very much goes with Yuval Nochri. That is their go-to ideal solution, or Shishish, or imported. Then maybe the Arava, Matzah Menutak, and only at the end, Oitze Beistin, which people don't really trust, and Heter Mechir, which everybody jumps up and down and screams about. Religious Zionist community, depending on who you ask. Usually Oitze Beistin is the primary go-to place, sometimes Heter Mechira, and then it goes down, and usually Yuval Nochri is at the end of that list as well, because they don't want to support the Arab producers, although again, it sometimes comes a little bit extreme when people don't ask those questions the rest of the cycle, but suddenly in Shemitah year, everybody's very, very principled about it. But there we are. So that's the penultimate shiur. But Ezrat Hashem, next week, we will look at some practical issues in the kitchen and the garden, and then we will probably all be quite relieved to go on to something which is not Shemitah related for the final shiur before Rosh Hashanah, assuming that there is one. We'll see. And we'll see whether we're live or we're not live at that point. But assuming that there is one, then there will be one, please God. But September is all Chagim anyway. So in any event, there are no Shurim after that until October. And we'll worry about October when it comes. Okay, have a wonderful week and a healthy week. And we'll see you next week, please God.